No relationships, except I hate the system. I'm going to give you a socialist analysis of the HIV/AIDS epidemic as a whole. And it's part of a book that we're working on to try to write this up, because the community groups around the world have been asking me and my colleagues to do this. And as I do it, it becomes a bigger and bigger and bigger process. So I'm having to go back and talk about the history of epidemics and realizing ways in which epidemics help to create capitalism, ways in which epidemics are shaped by capitalism, how specifically epidemics create the context that created the HIV virus and then spread it around so it became an epidemic. Some of the niches that capitalism presents. You'll notice I'm not talking here about individual behaviors. I'm talking about social niches that lead to mass spread through cities and other localities. The ideologies and structures of capitalist individualism and managerialism have as a way of shaping the response to the epidemic. The whole idea that everyone is now touting about the end of AIDS or AIDS-free generation, and is that realistic? And concluding thought, can we build a socialist AIDS left? So epidemics help to create capitalism as part of the process of history. People talk about the Black Death as having led to mass death of peasantry, change in the basic terms of negotiation over labor relations of peasants and feudal lords, and having been a major part of the process of creation of capitalism. But we have to understand also that the Black Death came about because you had the growth of trans-Eurasian trade with the Mongolian Empire setting up peaceful routes for some hundreds of years. And this led to rats and fleas and everything that people study and say, this is what causes Black Death, it's rats and fleas. Well, yeah, but also the basic processes of history. And also then you have situations like the wars between the Ottoman Empire and the Holy Roman Empire a couple hundred years later. Whereupon, as part of the tactics and strategies of trying to win that, the Ottomans basically cut off the spice trade. So how does the Holy Roman Empire, and in particular its Spanish branch, react? They do it by starting to look for other routes. And, you know, Columbus and all that stuff bringing both European barbarism, but in some ways more important, European pests and bacteria and viruses, which led to the deaths possibly of hundreds of millions of people on this continent. You know, they were able to conquer the Aztecs because they just had a major outbreak that had killed huge numbers of Aztecs and demoralized the society. And that's why they were able to conquer it, so that they're, based on this, they're able to conquer the islands and the U.S. South, which then become a critical part of the production system that generates capitalism, heavily through the creation of new forms of racism, new forms of gender relations, and slavery. So that everything that Kim was just talking about, you know, in some level dates back to this whole process. So that's how capitalism comes about. Then once you get capitalism, one of the basic processes is called proletarianization, which is that people are driven from the countryside into the cities. And in the cities, they live in rotten conditions. This is true around many cities in the world today. If you go to Sao Paulo, you'll see it, for example, or Durban, or you name it. When Engels was alive, you know, there was cholera and other stuff, and, you know, John Snow did his stuff around this whole issue. This is all part of the process of the development of capitalism also, leads to the development of imperialism, leads to the First World War. You probably may or may not know Paul Ewald's theories of viral evolution, that does a beautiful job of tracing how the specific microdynamics of how they dealt with sick and wounded people in the front lines and behind the front lines of the trench warfare led the flu virus to evolve to become the super thing that everyone now refers back to in the flu literature. One thing for dissertation topic or postdoc, if you've got one, is the following interesting question. What effect did the flu epidemic of 1918 and 19 have on the revolutionary wave that swept Europe at that time? Did that epidemic, in fact, condemn the human race to the last 100 years of misery? Or could we have had a successful, good revolution at that time? Turning, similar stuff can be said about malaria. The development of capitalist agriculture and imperialist agriculture reshapes where there's mosquito growing territory, creates situations of changing immunities in different locations. And if you look at the microhistory of malaria, you can see the history of capitalism and how it develops. HIV developed, as far as we can tell through phylogenetic and historical analysis, somewhere in the Congo Basin, Congo River Basin, somewhere in the first 20 years or so of the 1900s. It did so in part in the context of the Belgian conquest and its terrible brutalities. It's setting up rubber as a commodity. The growth of river trade throughout that area of Africa, all the way over to, you know, to the east coast of Africa. Workers traveling, you know, cities developing in where they weren't. Workers traveling, having sex, women becoming prostitutes because of the effects of racism and development of capitalism. This providing a slow spread of HIV. And, you know, with deaths that basically weren't being noticed much because they were mainly of black people. Medical systems were terribly underfunded. Needles were being reused. Certain evidence for iatrogenic transmission in East Africa as a part of this development. Now, and then it breaks out. It just spreads all over the place in the 1970s. And there's a number of, I'll take the next two or three slides to talk about some of that, but it's more useful to see HIV spread as a connected set of local events in certain cities or other localities globally. And, you know, we've traced this stuff using phylogenetic methods, so we have, as well as through history. And rather than as a mass of individual events, I know places in the world where I can go and have sex and share needles with anyone I want. I can have orgies, and the chances of my becoming infected are essentially zero. That was true everywhere in the world before 1800. I mean, you know, it's all socially situated. They're based on social and interaction patterns, based on the economics, history, and politics of capitalism in this historical period. It's a little out of order, but it's, you know, big events like the fall of the Soviet Union, the end of the South African apartheid, the overthrow of the Indonesian dictatorship have been followed by HIV outbreaks. But some big events, for example, similar overthrow of dictatorships in the Philippines, ongoing internal war in Colombia, have not, although there's some evidence they may finally be, been accompanied by big HIV epidemics, and we're trying to conduct research to figure out why not. The concept of niches is a very important one that we've been developing in about how this led to the outbreak. Think about gay liberation. Gay liberation came about in part because gay, first of all, establishes a category by moralist definitions by from on high by the elites. Gays then cluster in certain cities, set up in certain areas of cities, set up, you know, bars and this, that, and the other. They're being harassed, etc. Stonewall and similar events happen. They begin to win victories in the 1970s. Certain parts of the gay culture, by no means all of it, basically say freedom consists of having sex with anyone we want. This was a great idea. A lot of fun was had. But the problem is it also led to this. It was at the wrong time. HIV was around, and it led to a nightmare. And we all know about that. The beginning of neoliberalism was in part the New York fiscal crisis of the mid-1970s, when the New York banks and other leaders of capitalism said, we need to crack down on workers because we're not getting the profits we need. And they basically did, you know, the Wallaces have showed they defunded fire stations in a lot of the minority areas. The results of this, plus the certain amount of greed and burning of buildings in order to get insurance money, led to massive burnouts of whole parts of New York, super overcrowding around the edges of it, and youth, and a lot of places where drug users could congregate in old burned out buildings to shoot up together outside of the eyes of the police. Result, mass HIV spread. HIV prevalence went from essentially two infected people in 1975 in New York up to something like 100,000 infected injection drug users in 1981 or 82 or so. South African mines, everyone knows who's in the field about them as a locus of transmission. You've got men, miners, in a legally, totally segregated society. Women can get money somewhat by coming and selling sex with them. Lo and behold, the virus spreads all over. People then go back to their countryside homes, spreads again. After the fall of the Soviet Union, in Ukraine and in Russia, youth got into situations where they were despairing. There was no normative control over them because the adult generation was discredited in their eyes. They do sex, they do drugs, they get HIV and other infections. In East Africa, as Sonia Majola's analysis of East African epidemic and consuming women shows, she doesn't necessarily agree with what I'm about to say, but proletarianization of the women coming out of the countryside into schools in the city, they need to buy Tampax, they need to buy other stuff. This is classic proletarianization. And how do they deal with it? Sex. Sex for support. And the result is HIV all over the place. How have we responded? How am I on time, by the way? I haven't seen.
Coming up to 5 minutes.
Okay. Think about the ideologies of the response. Individualism and managerialism have been critical. The focus on individual risk factors and epidemiology is part and parcel of the capitalist individualist whole approach that underlies things like neoliberalism or Keynesianism when you really look at it carefully. Behavioral interventions, all of it's based on the individual behaviors. Some of us have been able to push the envelope there into various kinds of collective and community stuff. But even there, I'll talk about it in a minute. Managerialism assumes, and it's rampant in this conference, that public health funders and medical agencies should decide policies and interventions. And it's and then they analyze their successes in things like smallpox, STIs, or family planning, and they say, we know how to do it, we've got the expertise, give us the money. And CDC's ideology of how to respond to the HIV epidemic was shaped very much by people who had worked on the smallpox stuff, like Steve Jones, and other things. But best intentions in the world, but an ideology of top-down. The whole thing about moralism and scapegoating ideologies, which are fed and supported by the normal routine workings of capitalist politics. You need to keep power, divide and rule is the classic way of doing it. Point to racial minorities, point to gays, point to drug users, just say no. Talk about sex workers as being trafficked and therefore it's all a moral question. Lo and behold, you get HIV epidemics. And you don't know how to respond to them effectively because you're being guided by these very moralistic and scapegoating ideologies. Unfortunately, you know, at the beginning of AIDS in the United States, we had a fair amount of radicalism. We had ACT UP, we had the harm reduction movement, underground needle exchanges. It was really quite exciting for a while. CDC, once again with the best of intentions, said we have to fund these guys to do effective interventions. We know what they are because we've done got all the scientific research. They're individual interventions that focus on X, Y, and Z. We'll fund you guys if you'll do those kinds of research. These community-based organizations, many, not all, needed the money. They accepted it and tried to do it as best they could. They did a certain amount of non-individual focused stuff with the money. But by and large, this essentially affects how they start thinking of the reality too. Community becomes a fetish, community becomes, you know, all sorts of things, and leads to problems. They're now talking a lot about human rights, the best of them. But when you push and see what they mean by human rights, 80% of the time that's human rights from above, involving lawyers and stuff like that, rather than human rights involving mass action from below. It can be effective to do it that way. You know, I'm not knocking it for tactical stuff. But if that's the whole thrust, it limits where you can go. Now, everyone, you know, I sat a couple years ago in Washington, D.C., listening to Hillary Clinton talk about the end of AIDS and AIDS-free generations, with Tony Fauci supporting her at the end of the AIDS, you know, at the AIDS conference. And, you know, already by then and more since then, it's been clear that the cutbacks to the Global Fund and other programs, or even their leveling off, means that the end of AIDS isn't going to happen the way they say they are. Treatment as prevention is not going to happen on a large enough scale to end the epidemic. On top of that, we have global warming. Mass movements of refugees. We're going to have hundreds of millions of refugees. Syria is going to look like just the beginning within a relatively few years. We're going to lose the capacity to get volunteers for various community activities because they're all going to be working around global warming issues and probably should be. And the money is going to be shifting even more out of public health of other kinds and into global warming mitigation. So as a concluding thought, can we build a socialist AIDS left? If there's one real regret I have of my work in this field, it's that I was never able to figure out how to do that. Partly because the focus was so much on community this, community that, but whenever I'd start talking about class struggle, they'd talk about community. And they were fixed on a mindset and an ideology that's very strong. And it's based on lived practice. I mean, we don't exactly have working class revolutions flowering everywhere. We have a few. So, you know, as a question to the audience, how can we move ahead on this?
So let's take a couple of questions for now, and then let's continue that discussion at the end. Somebody have a question? No? Okay. Yes.
I'm having a little trouble hearing you.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, you have to use shout.
My name is Linda Campbell, and I was around in the mid-80s when we started doing the HIV prevention work. I worked with a radical group of African Americans in the city of Detroit who did a lot of that initial harm reduction work. In my opinion, what really got in the way of the radical movement in HIV was the over-professionalization of the movement. Mm-hmm. Those vast group folks, many of them who were living with HIV/AIDS, were fighting for their lives and willing to do some of the very kinds of radical things that you're positioning. When the funding started coming into the community, there was a demand that there be a more professionalized face to the movement. I don't think that gets talked about enough when we sort of do the critique of the HIV/AIDS movement. Transparency, I'm a professional. I had an MPH back then, but I learned how to step out of that role and allow community folks, non-professionalized folks, so to speak, to lead. So I'd like you, when you're thinking about your presentation, to lift that up.
Yeah.
As one of the major barriers to the radicalization of the
movement. In a certain sense, that's what I thought I said. You said it much better. Okay. I clearly didn't succeed in saying it right.